This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, watchers and observers, critics and critiquers, insiders and outsiders. I am Brooke Warner here, as always, week in and week out with my right-minded co-host, Grant Faulkner. And we're taking on the topic of social responsibility in fiction. And Grant, you know, we've already done the interview with our guest today. And so I think it's more than that. I mean, it's like embracing all of these categories of literary fiction and insider-outsider fiction. So there's just a lot going on in this episode that you're all going to love today. I also love that this juxtaposes in a lot of ways our recent episode about lighthearted fiction, because we get to cover on this show all the different reasons that people come to fiction. You know, some writers come to make a point, to champion a cause, and others write to escape or to have fun. And there's room in this writing tent for everyone. But I want to delve into this question of where and when social responsibility starts to weigh on authors, because that's in part what we're going to talk about with today's guest, Naomi Kanakia. Naomi is a trans author whose latest book, The Default World, centers a character named John V, who's hatched a plan to marry a friend she's known since college in order to get on his health plan so that she can get gender-confirming surgery. And yet, she sort of despises this person for his values and how he lives. And she certainly hates his housemates. That was my take on it. You'll see in the interview that Naomi has sort of a different take, and that, you know, John V becomes friends with these people over time. But it is a book about class and privilege. It's a critique of a certain brand of San Francisco elitism, where people are all about helping the underprivileged while judging them harshly. And so there's a lot of discomfort in this book. But my underlying feeling as I read it is that Naomi is telling it like it is from her lived experience. And the social responsibility thing that Naomi brings to the fore, Grant, is from a quote that I read from her where she was working on a previous book. And then she says, the idea of social responsibility in fiction is the same as lying. She says, if you write a book that has moral clarity, then you're either writing an unambitious book or you're distorting the truth. But then, you know, she starts working on this young adult novel, Just Happy to Be Here. And lo and behold, because she's writing about trans characters, you know, transitioning and teenage trans experience, she started to feel this nagging sense of social responsibility. So the point is that she changed her mind. And Grant, I'd love to hear your reaction to that, you know, this change of perspective.
It's so interesting. It's an interesting quote, and it's interesting because of the ways that writers have dealt with like social responsibility in their writing, and whether they embrace it or they ignore it, or they kind of hope it comes through just based on their own interests of what they write about. And, you know, I guess in the end, one thing I want to say is that one of the beauties of fiction is that it offers just a number of ways to define what social responsibility is. And I think every writer should take that on. And it's a lifelong question, really. I mean, I ask it all the time. And I remember in one of our interviews with Nana Kwame Adebrenya that he defined his activism as starting with love. So he viewed everything he wrote about with that frame, which I thought was really interesting, because he wrote about intense stuff and intense racism through the frame of love. And so it was a way for him to look at our messy lives through love. So a character can hold contradictions and faults, but still be rendered compassionately. And I think there's been a resistance to social responsibility especially in the kind of higher literary world, for lack of a better word, because of the fear that, you know, writing with a lens of social responsibility might make the story didactic or preachy, and that that can certainly be a danger. So it's maybe less appealing as a result. But social responsibility also means representation, and centering the trans experience in a novel makes it a novel of social responsibility no matter what. And especially the way Naomi defines that, as we learn in the interview, about not sugarcoating the experience, not making it kind of neat and tidy. And one common bit of advice, though, given to writers is to write for the questions, not the answers. But it sounds like Naomi maybe writes with both the answers and the questions in mind.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and we're going to pose that to her in the interview. And, you know, Naomi has written across so many different genres, sci-fi, YA, and also about the world of writing, the literary great books that she's writing about. And it's also so interesting to hear her take on that, because she's clearly well-read, and also living in the margins, right? So just by the very nature of being trans, you know, never mind a trans writer. And so the things that she's thinking about, they center perhaps different questions. And I think it's also why it's so important to listen to the experience of writers like her, because being in the margins allows you to speak truth to power in ways that not everyone can. I think sometimes not everyone sees, you know, or just accepts the status quo, how it is. And I was really struck by how much of Naomi's newest novel, the one that's just forthcoming, The Default World, addresses challenges trans people face, as well as internalized transphobia. She really got to the heart of what it feels like to be in the body of a trans person, you know, how it's both authentic and truly hard. And I want to read novels like this because it helps me to understand experiences, right? It's hard to be in any body, but especially a marginalized body, and especially in our culture right now, where there's a lot of transphobia, a lot of violence, a lot of legislation against trans bodies. And then John V herself is a complicated character. She's judging the people that she's also trying to take advantage of, and yet she's taking advantage of them to balance the uneven power structure at play that gives these so-called friends so many more advantages than she has, including, of course, access to medical benefits. So it's kind of an upsetting book at times, but I kept turning the page because I was also really invested in finding out what happened to her. You know, you want her to get that surgery, and at the same time, you know, like I said, I couldn't help but feel that she was a little bit entitled, and that's good. You know, in some ways, I think that fiction like that challenges us.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Brooke. And Naomi's book is a cultural critique about millennials, but also about tech culture and big money and who gets what and why. And the money at some of these jobs right now in Silicon Valley is just so beyond the scale of what normal people make. And that kind of thing seems ripe for novelists to take on. And I think back in literary history, when authors like Ibsen or Emile Zola were writing, I think it was 100, 130 years ago, maybe, who wrote in this literary naturalist style, which might seem tame to us now, but it was meant to shock the bourgeoisie, you know, to provoke and outrage it and to prod it out of that passive and self-contented state. So that was what it meant to write with social responsibility back then. And I'm not sure if that's still possible today, or it's not in the same way, but I think there will always be novelists out there with an eye and an understanding for what's really happening and who can call it like it is, you know, consequences be damned. And there's obviously a lot to critique in modern culture, and there's a lot wrong that demands our attention. And fiction does provide a forum for these kinds of thoughts and conversations that, you know, that's less confrontational, I guess, and that can often provide people a window into something they know but don't know how to articulate.
Yeah, it's such a good reminder, and often why fiction has such a deep cultural impact. I mentioned something about the shock of recognition when we interviewed Lissa Soep, because when I was in grad school, that was a central tenet of my social studies curriculum. You know, this idea that when you see something presented that you understand to be true, but you had never really thought to articulate it in such a way, that's shock of recognition. You know, and our best writers and thinkers and scholars give us this shock of recognition all the time, and it can be very powerful. And there was a lot of that in this novel for me, especially because it's a San Francisco novel and we live in the Bay Area. I actually know someone, a friend's son-in-law, who works at OpenAI, and I can't even say out loud what his salary is because the number is so obscene. And so there are all these young people in tech, and they're making so much money, you know, and it's contrasted with the marginalized communities who, you know, it's like they might not even have a next paycheck. They're, I don't even know, one prayer away from being homeless, right? And not to mention the unhoused crisis in so many cities, and San Francisco is particularly bad. So this character, John V, has this entitlement that I mentioned, but she's right. You know, she would have benefit from this surgery that would essentially feel free to these other people. And so you're grappling with it, right? The very thing that is off-putting, you're also sort of wanting for this character, because it's a real contrast between the haves and the have-nots. And a certain subset of fiction, as you just said, Grant, has always existed to be a critique of our culture. And I think about so many novels that have served that very purpose over the years, classics like Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, Sinclair's The Jungle, Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, and then more recently books like Naomi Adler's The Power, which is one of my favorite in recent times, Americana by Chimamanda Adichie, or as you mentioned, you know, so prominently of the moment is Aggie Brenya's Chinggang All-Stars. And I'm curious to know what some of your favorites, Grant, you know, specifically novels that have stuck with you that have this socially responsible theme running through.
Yeah. In the trans canon, actually, I'm thinking of, I think it's pronounced Imogen Binney's novel, Nevada. And it was published originally in 2013 by the trans focused, but now defunct, Topside Press. And the novel was fortunately just reissued by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. So it's getting some real New York Big Five publisher street cred there. And Nevada is about the, you know, the groups we create in the age of the internet. And it's really a lovely reading experience for me formally, because the story is told in 60 brief chapters. And it's written, the author says that the novel isn't seeking validation from cis people. And she writes this in her new afterword, you know. And so the novel has this defiance, and it feels very punk rock. And, you know, with that punk rock spirit, it reminds me of one of my other favorite books that's about gay life and AIDS in the 80s. David Wanorowicz is Close to the Knives, which I've talked about on past shows. But it's really interesting because it's both poetic and shocking and disturbing and more all in one book. And then I'm also going to mention Claudia Rankine's Citizen, an American Lyric. It's a book-length poem about race and the imagination, and she called it an attempt to pull the lyric back into its realities, and it definitely achieves that. It's fascinating kind of collage of a book that comments on acts of everyday racism, you know, includes remarks and glances and implied judgments. And, you know, as I mentioned, it's a poem, yet it's part documentary, part lyric procedural, and it covers, you know, everything from J.M.W. Turner's painting The Slave Ship to Zinedine Zidane's headbutt incident during the 2006 World Cup final. So covers a lot, but it's just a brilliant book.
That's great. And some of these books really do cover so much, and it's so important. I mean, this whole thing of having different kinds of protagonists who draw you into their worlds, right? And who are grappling with a lot of different things. And it might be similar to what you're going through. It might be quite different than what you're going through. You know, in this book, John V wants her future to be very different. You know, she wants it to conform to how she sees herself, wants to see herself. You know, her parents are not exactly supportive of her being trans. You know, she doesn't feel great in her body. She's too big, not feminine enough, you know, doesn't feel easy as a woman. And so just in the terms of like reading trans literature, I've read many trans memoirs, but not a whole lot of trans novels. And I just do really appreciate Naomi grappling with some of the things, like she said, about the fact that it is hard, you know, that it's not always this joyful experience. And I think sometimes people feel compelled to do that, you know, so that people will be like, oh, I turned out okay, you know, or this is what it was meant to be. I mean, I find that in memoir a lot, right? It's kind of like they're trying to make other people okay with their choice. Not that they're not okay with their choice, it's just that sometimes there's nuance here that you can explore a little better in fiction. And so that is, I guess, the point, right? I mean, the social responsibility is also about seeing the nuance, about championing, you know, all kinds of voices, and ultimately creating compassion too.
Our task in writing and reading fiction in the end is to connect with others and to make others feel less other, in short. And I think that unto itself is an act of social responsibility. And per your quote, Brooke, about the news for trans people getting worse in the last few years, you know, that's the reason we need books that center trans people. And I can't remember who said this, but the quote is that it's hard to hate another once we know their story. So that's social responsibility to me, is making that connection with another person through a story. We're all more alike than different in the end. So I look forward to talking more with Naomi after this short break.
Welcome back, everyone. Today's guest is Naomi Kanakia. She is the author of 3 YA novels and a nonfiction book, What's So Great About Great Books, coming out next year from Princeton University Press. Her stories, poetry, and essays have been published in American Short Fiction, Asimov's, Gulf Coast, and elsewhere. Her latest novel is The Default World, and it's also forthcoming this spring from the Feminist Press. She has an MFA from Johns Hopkins and was an Emerging LGBTQ Voices Fellow at Lambda Literary's 2015 Writers Retreat. She lives in San Francisco with her wife and daughter. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you. Welcome.
So before you came on, Grant and I were chatting about social responsibility in fiction, in part because of a quote I saw from you that was grappling with that very concept. You said in an essay you wrote that the idea of responsibility in fiction is the same as lying. But then you were working on your YA novel, Just Happy to Be Here, and the nagging sense of social responsibility crept into your process. And I guess I have to say that's understandable given the topics that you write about. And so I'm wondering if you can share what that was like for you, and how do you think about social responsibility in fiction now, especially in light of your most recent novel, The Default World?
You know, I guess what I had thought about in terms of social responsibility was like, oh, there are things that we shouldn't about ourselves that we shouldn't say in front of outsiders. You know, like I was reading about The Invisible Man recently, and when Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man came out, there was just like this horrific uproar. Like, how dare Ralph Ellison, you know, like there's a scene in there where they go and visit a sharecropper who's impregnated his own daughter. It's like, you know, how dare Ralph Ellison show Black people like this? So to me, it's like social responsibility is basically just sugarcoating things for outsiders so they don't get the idea that we're not, you know, perfect victims. But when writing Just Happy to Be Here, I like started to feel, I would say, a different sense of social responsibility, which is the book is marketed towards teens. There really aren't a lot of books out there featuring trans girls and trans women. And I was like, oh, you know, some teenager, like this book could be what they get their idea of what being trans is like. And I felt like that kind of much more deeply personal responsibility to that person who might be reading the book. And, you know, I felt like it was kind of a tightrope walk because on the one hand, I feel like a lot of depictions of trans teens are like really sugarcoated, you know, like they're really very gender affirming. There's like the parents are so accepting, like everybody's so pleased. And it's just like, that's just really tends to not be what it's like, you know, like having come out, you know, as like I came out as gay and then coming out as trans, it's very, very different. In modern society, like people are not excited about you transitioning. Like people definitely try and test you and like, you know, get you to reconsider. It's a very lonely road. And I kind of wanted, and I think like I wanted to prepare teenagers for that idea that like, you know, this is like something you do on your own. You can't expect anybody else to be more sure about this than you are. And so, but then on the other hand, you know, obviously I don't want to make it sound like it's really terrible and horrific. So I think like I wanted to, you know, show how if you're trans, like how great it is to transition and how life changing. So I really felt that responsibility of like, you know, there are these two truths that like transitioning is really great. And then that it's also really, really difficult. And then kind of how to just mix those when this might be the only, you know, book about a trans girl that somebody is reading, or the first book about a trans girl that somebody's reading, did kind of weigh on me.
Naomi, I'm so fascinated by this. And I think like I'm going to focus on your word sugarcoating, you know, and sugarcoating the experience or making it too, I don't know, easy or digestible. And, you know, when Brooke and I were talking about writing with a sense of social responsibility, yeah, there's a whole kind of tradition in especially literary fiction about kind of resisting that, I guess. So there's this common advice given to writers to write for the questions, not the answers. And we were speculating that you do a bit of both, but I was wondering if you can give us your take on carrying out social responsibility in fiction and, like you said, writing in that way. Go ahead.
I think literary writers kind of protest too much about like how they don't, you know, write with a sense of social responsibility or whatever. Because like, yeah, you know, maybe they don't have like some sort of overt political aim in how they write, but in their books, the politics always seem to be pretty perfect, right? You know, like very little slips in there that's like kind of like that seriously questions, you know, like you're not going to, if you read, you know, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, you're not going to see something in there that's like, oh, maybe, you know, the Vietnam War was good. Mm-hmm. You're not really going to see anything in these books that questions these certain like political orthodoxies. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, I mean, maybe literary writers don't write with a sense of social responsibility, or maybe their politics are just so good that like they never, like kind of never comes up in their writing. But yeah, like it's just not believable that like people, some of these writers don't kind of like write with a view to like how the politics of their books will be read.
It's an interesting take, yeah. And one you must be thinking about a lot with this book that you're working on right now and working about the classics and the canon, which we're going to get to in a minute. So I wanted to ask you first about The Default World, which is this new novel coming out on the feminist press. I read it and really enjoyed it. I mean, your protagonist is John V. She's a trans woman, and her basically she and her longtime friend agree that they'll get married so that she can use his healthcare to get gender affirming surgery. And this guy, her friend, you'll say more about it, but he lives in this house full of very progressive fire eaters, which I took to be a nod to burners. But the entire thing is like a takedown of a certain element of San Francisco culture. And Grant and I are here in the Bay Area in Berkeley. You're in San Francisco. So, you know, it's like we know these people, I think, you know, or at least cross paths with them. But a lot of the elements in this household are pretty awful. But sometimes John V isn't all that sympathetic either. You know, she's an interesting protagonist because I was rooting for her, but I also found her to be entitled at times, like really expecting certain things. And I just wanted to ask you about what it was like to show this character in this house full of cringy hyper progressives.
I do think she's certainly entitled, but all of her friends are like, they're moving forward with life. And like, she's just supposed to kind of like sit back and like be good and like save up all this money to get to, you know, to get to first base.
Right.
Isn't that like, you know, with these politics that we all have where like some people have a lot more than other people, then like, shouldn't the other people feel entitled to what the some people have?
Well, it's a great point. And I guess I want you to say more about it, you know, especially from a perspective of a trans, who, like you said, a trans woman who needs to spend all this money just to get to baseline. And then she's working with these people who she essentially finds horrific, who have all this money. It's just, I thought it was really a fascinating take. And I hope people will read it, you know, simply for the, I guess, the politics of equity and other concerns around healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think she particularly... I don't think she finds them horrific so much as she envies them. Hmm. You know, like she wants to be one of them. She likes them.
Oh, interesting.
I think like even as the book progressed, like she kind of starts to regard them more or less as like her friends, and vice versa. Like the part, you know, with burners, like the part I've never understood is like all the kind of like self-interrogation or like the self-doubt, you know, like, The part everybody seems to hate, which is like the part where you get together, do a lot of drugs, have sex with each other, spend lots of money on like spectacle and entertainment. Like that seems totally comprehensible. Like, why wouldn't you do that? You know, anybody would do that if they were a 25-year-old who earned like $300,000 a year. What's never made sense is like, why do that and then feel so bad about it?
Hmm. Well, Naomi, you write across many genres, and you write science fiction and fantasy, and you write contemporary young adult novels, and The Default World is literary fiction, and then your Princeton University book is nonfiction, you know, a book about books. And so you're interesting because you equally embrace highbrow and lowbrow, and, you know, you're obviously incredibly well versed in books. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about your education, your reading habits, and in particular, I saw a quote in which you said that the process of selling the default world left you somewhat contemptuous of the world of high culture. So I'm always curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, well, I've always had the ambition to write books that were taken seriously as literature. And then growing up, I mostly read science fiction and fantasy. And then I applied to MFA programs after graduating college. And I was caught outside the literary world. And then I got rejected by all the MFA programs that I applied to. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to be better than them at their own game. Like, I'm going to read all of these books that, you know, are supposedly so good that they like and think are better than, you know, the science fiction books that I love. So that's when I started reading all these great books. And yeah, I came into it from a point of being like, oh, you know, like popular literature, commercial literature can be just as good as literary fiction. And I do think that's true. You know, there are definitely science fiction writers who are as good as anybody who's writing literary fiction, like Ted Chiang. Karen Joy Fowler has broken into the mainstream, but like Maureen McHugh, both like incredible writers, Nancy Kress. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be like one of those writers. And I tried again to get into an MFA program. I got into Johns Hopkins. You know, I like haven't necessarily worried too much about where my writing would land up. I think it's just good to work. Like, some things are definitely just a lot easier to sell as certain kinds of books. Like my first book, Enter Title Here, it maybe could have sold as a literary book, but it just was a lot easier to sell as a young adult book. And I got a lot more money for it than I would have gotten as a literary book. But at some point, I did really want to write and sell like a literary book for adults. Like, I started to really idealize that because I felt like I very much like felt the constraints of YA, like, you know, that things have to be written in a certain style. Like, it usually has to be in the first person. You can't write anything in retrospective. Like, it's kind of, everything kind of really has to be in scene. And then like some of the kind of like content norms, like especially for queer YA, like everything has to be like so upbeat all the time. And so I was like, oh yeah, literary writers, like they're so free. They can write whatever they want. So I wrote The Default World and I tried to sell it. And it was just really, really hard, difficult, kind of embittering experience. Like, my agent at the time basically was like, I don't like it. And he essentially fired me. I had to find a new agent. And then I looked for a new agent for a year. I got like hundreds of rejections. It was much, much harder to find an agent for my literary fiction than for my young adult work. I think like with YA, like I grew to kind of appreciate the honesty of the young adult field, which is, in YA, like, it's very easy to tell what's hot and what's not. And so it's kind of your duty as an author to give editors something that might conceivably sell or like have a good commercial value proposition. But then editors, they don't necessarily care that much about like what's in the book. Like, you know, like they're not like micromanaging what's inside the book. Like with Just Happy to Be Here, like I was able to make those tonal changes. I was able to like put in a lot of this like trans stuff. Like a trans care band stuff that I wanted to put in. And like the publisher didn't really care as long as it was still like a trans girl YA romance. With literary fiction, like the editors really are looking for it to like have some kind of like extra literary value, like to be of importance in some way. But I kind of like started to feel like I didn't really respect their judgment of like what constituted good or important. Like, it's kind of like we were talking about earlier, Grant, you know, like they'll say like, oh, we don't want like a book that has a message, you know, like we don't want something that's like has the overt politics. But all the books they publish have like really legible overt politics. And then I think for me, like the final straw was when I was looking for an agent, you know, I got these tons and tons of rejections. And then I eventually got an offer on a third, one Just Happy to Be Here, on a third young adult that I pitched independently to my agent. And like, I went back to all the agents who had been ghosting me on my literary novel. And I was like, hey, I have this offer, blah, blah, blah. And then like, I shook loose like a half dozen offers of representation from those agents in basically the course of like 4 or 5 days. And I was like, oh, like these agents have been telling me all this time, like, oh, it's about quality, or it's like about fit, or like it's about this or that. But really, it's just about like, they want to sell books. you know?
Sure. You kind of pulled back the veil a bit.
Yeah. I mean, and it would be one thing if they were like, oh yeah, we're happy to represent you on the YA, but like, we're not sure about the literary book. But no, when they came back, they were very excited about the literary book too. Once I'd shown them that like I could sell books and like that I was a going concern, it like everything was kind of different. So I just was kind of like, I think if you're going to have this rhetoric about like, we want, you know, special, unique voices that are different, then you also need to have like independent literary judgment that you trust.
Right.
And I just stopped feeling like a lot of like agents and editors really had that.
Well, Naomi, you're walking me right into my next question, because you have this such an interesting and compelling take on the literary world. And I was thinking to myself that you're a fascinating character yourself, because you are inside outside, right? And I'm guessing this is not just true in the literary world, and maybe that's why you see what you see. But about lit fiction, you have written that it's not a meritocracy, that most literary writers come from well-off or well-connected backgrounds. You wrote that they start on third base. I just wanted to quote you saying this because I think it's important for others to hear, which is, the path for a middle-class person to make it in lit fic is pretty narrow. They need to get into good schools and get awards and fellowships and sell a novel relatively quickly for a relatively large sum before they reach an age when they'd want to start a family and own a home. It's doable, but it's hard. Whereas more privileged people like me can afford to fail again and again and to develop at our own speed. So I thought that was interesting, your use of, you being more privileged. And I wondered if you would say more about your own privilege, and also if you agree with this, you know, idea of being inside outside.
Yeah. I mean, so I belong to this writing community, the Ruby, here in San Francisco, which is great. And there are a lot of aspiring writers there. And a lot of them are from pretty middle-class backgrounds. Like, you know, like they have day jobs and they're working for a living. And they support their families with money that they earn. And they'll like kind of repeat advice from writing instructors. And I know, because I'm a little bit inside, that like those instructors have very different financial backgrounds than they do. Writing instructors will say things like, don't worry about the market. Just take as long as you need to. It doesn't matter if you take 10 years to write this book. Like, just make sure it's perfect. I'm like, well, yeah, but like that person who like you're telling me their advice, like that person is married to an investment banker, you know, like, but they don't know. The people, you know, I talk to like middle class people all the time who like are playing the game in the same way that, you know, much wealthier people are playing it. But like they don't realize that there's this kind of disconnect between their lives and the lives of like the people they look up to. As for myself, I mean, like, yeah, you know, when you're in your 20s, you don't realize how important, you know, these things are. Like, when you're in your 20s, you can live on like $30,000 or $40,000 a year, and you know, just like organize your life to find ways of writing. But you know, most people want to find love. Most people want to have families. Most people want to, you know, put down roots somewhere. And to do that, you need you need an income. And I mean, I'm the same way, right? Like my Princeton Press book was the last book I sold. I got $9,000 for. Like this feminist press book, I got $6,500 for. Like even my last YA, Just Happy to Be Here, I got, I think, $30,000. Yeah, I got $30,000 for. So like, you know, I live in San Francisco, like I have a child, like all of that is not really paying the bills. You know, my family is relatively well off. My spouse is a doctor. To somebody who's like in my social class, my income situation is like very instantly legible. The same way like I look at other literary writers and see how they live and what they've done for money, and like their situation is very legible too. But like to the middle class people who like form the bulk of the audience for literary fiction, they don't really perceive those like kind of hidden messages.
Thank you, Naomi. I think that's all really important to point out. And I've definitely experienced it myself and observed it, as I think most writers who've been around for as long as I have and you have. I wanted to talk a little bit about your Princeton Press book. And as one, you know, who I came up and was educated with this notion of the great books and the canon, and then I experienced and was part of, you know, deconstructing the canon and taking it down and opening it up. So I'm really interested in your take on great books and what they have. I guess the premise of your book is that they have a lot to offer the left-wing people and racial, gender, and sexual minorities. And I think that's a great premise. So just curious if you can tell us more about the book and, you know, maybe share some of the great books that you're including and how you're grappling with the fact that the classic canon is so male and so white.
Yeah, I think like one of the key things is two things that are underappreciated about great books is one, they come to us from outside capitalism. We do not read Plato because like it makes someone money. Plato's reputation was established long before there was capitalism. So the great books have a source of value that is really independent from the judgments of the marketplace. And I think like a lot of people perceive that value to be arbitrary, like that value comes to us, you know, because like white people and men have this incentive to establish their culture and like their sex as being superior to the others. So they've like held up these books as being superior. But I do think it's more complicated than that. You know, like if you read Plato or you read, if you read the great books, like you see that there really is something there that there's like a sense of beauty there and truth that is objective, you know, like that there's something there that is really good. And like, there's something there for everybody.
Thank you, Naomi. We really appreciate your take on these things and being on the show.
You're welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Naomi. So many wonderful thought-provoking ideas you put forth.
We'll be right back after this short break with today's book trend.
Well, Brooke, a lot of our book trends and our topics on the show in general have been about the systemic racism in publishing, both in terms of who works in publishing, but then also in what books get published. And surprise, surprise, the two are connected. And in one of the groundbreaking surveys that raised this issue back in 2015 was the Diversity Baseline Survey, which is created by Lee and Lowe Books. And it was created to answer a question: does the book industry have a diversity problem? And back then, there wasn't a benchmark to measure the demographics of the publishing workforce. And now the survey has become an industry standard. And the 2023 survey results were just released. I think the last time the survey was done was 2019. So it's a really interesting time period to judge the two, you know, surveys against each other. So, Brooke, I know you've read it. So did anything jump out to you?
The main thing, yes, is that change happens slowly. A lot of people have the opinion that publishing has dramatically changed, especially since 2020. You know, some have the complaint that white people are being squeezed out. But the survey says, nope, status quo hasn't changed a whole lot. For example, when the survey was first administered in 2015, 79% of the respondents identified as white. In 2023, 72.5% identified as white, 72.5%. Mm-hmm. So that improvement shows that the publishing industry is becoming more inclusive, but hardly.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the largest change in racial categories was in the biracial, multiracial category at 8.4%, which was an increase of over 5% from 2019. But overall, the rest of the publishing industry is almost completely unchanged in terms of, you know, racial self-identification. And a particular note, there continues to be alarming lack of representation within the publishing workforce of American Indian, Alaska Native, First Nations, Native American, which just includes 0.1%. And then Middle Eastern people as well just have 0.5% or represented by 0.5% of employees. And then the Black African representation is holding steady at 5.3%, which is consistent with 2019, which was 5%. In 2015, it was 4%. So the increase, you know, so nominal that it's not statistically significant. One other thing, the other group that's holding steady is Asian, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander at 7.8%. And this, like the Black African representation, has seen a, you know, just a slight increase over the years from the 7% seen across both 2015 and 2019 surveys. And then there's an actual decrease of negative 1.4% in the people who self-identify as Hispanic, Latino, Mexican at 4.6%. And this decrease from both 2015, which was 6%, and 2019, which was 6%, is enough of a loss to be considered statistically significant. So sorry to dig in with all those numbers. I hope people can pause and read them. They're very fascinating.
It is really interesting. And to look at, I mean, like you said, it's so steady, just really incremental change, but an interesting place to look at the loss of the Latino statistic there. Mm-hmm. The gender makeup didn't change dramatically either. 2019 reported 74% of people who work in the publishing industry self-report as cis women. And then the current survey is 71%. So that's just very close. And then 91.9% of publishing staff identify as cis men or women, meaning they identify with the gender they were assigned to at birth. That doesn't seem surprising to me, actually. That mm-hmm. number seems even like it might be growth, but I'm not sure. Gay representation held steady at 4%. This is interesting too, though. I'm curious about, you know, how broad these surveys actually go out, you know, what publishing houses are included, but I do appreciate these numbers. I just think the gay and lesbian representation might be a little higher than this. Says only 3% and 4%, and like just in terms of people I know, I'm like, maybe it could be higher. And then the greatest change is seen in disability. In 2019, 11% identified as having some kind of disability, and then in 2023, 16.2%. So that also probably speaks to the fact that more people are feeling comfortable with naming their disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to your point about who the survey goes out to, I know that they got more broad results. You know, they did get results from, or the survey was returned from a lot of publishing houses. So I think it's pretty indicative, but I think they also like contextualize it that the number of respondents they get can affect these numbers. So that's worth pointing out.
Right.
And I'll just say that, you know, even though these results are obviously not worth celebrating, I think one thing that is worth celebrating is that the conversation is growing, and I hope that the conversation leads to change. And in closing, I just want to note a few other resources that are similar to this. And, you know, grassroots organizations, People of Color in Publishing and Latinx in Publishing, they also released findings of their workplace racism survey. So look that up. And PEN America has, you know, offered its analysis of the industry and its Reading Between the Lines report, which is super, super interesting. I recommend that. And then the American Library Association, you reported that the highest number of attempted book bans since the ALA began compiling data about the censorship in libraries more than 20 years ago is happening now. And many of the books being challenged are by and about people of color and or, you know, who are LGBTQ+. So I hope you all stay involved in these very important conversations and contribute to them on the page and beyond. We will be back to continue the conversation next week and to talk to you about all the sorts of things to keep in mind to be right-minded. See you then.